It's good to have you here. It is an encouragement. Gives glory to God and great help to us as well. But if you have been with us in recent weeks, we have now, I think it's 18 weeks, that we have been working our way verse by verse through the book of Ephesians. The little slide paper that I selected there was intended to try to show that the first three chapters are really very distinct from chapters 4 through 6. The first three chapters are of a more doctrinal sort of nature. When you come to chapter 4 and verse 1, you have a different sort of material that's being presented. We have seen that there are spiritual blessings that are introduced at the very beginning of Acts chapter 1, and in the first three chapters, 24 of those 29 blessings are set forth, many of them in the form of prayers that Paul offers, twice in fact. The first chapter and again in the third chapter, Paul, which makes it twice as much as he offers prayer in any other epistle, is intent on helping us today, certainly beginning 2,000 years ago with the Ephesians, to have these blessings, to see that they're working in our lives, to have from the hand of God these great gifts that they might change us, and that they might empower us to be what he would have us be and to do what he would have us do. So Paul prays fervently that these blessings will enter into our lives. And then suddenly introduces at the start of chapter 2 the very wretched condition that everyone is in when they are serving themselves, when they are foolishly living in the world and caring little about the God who created them or the future that lies ahead for all of us. And so after so many of these spiritual blessings, which is the plus side, he then, turns very shockingly, suddenly, to how desperately it is that we need him. But then that is for the purpose as well of setting forth this great reconciliation between both God and man, as well as between Jew and Gentile. The Old Testament to this day is something of a mystery, I think, for a lot of people. Paul admits that an animosity was created by God between this chosen nation of the Jews and all others on the surface of the earth. This had a good purpose. It worked a great good thing for the world. God used this separation between these two races or types of kinds of people, for a good purpose as an illustration of being close to God and being far from God. But he loved everyone. He loved all peoples. And while he had purposes of his own, magnificent, wonderful, and wise purposes in effecting this separation of the Old Testament, it now is being obliterated. God is reconciling Jew and Gentile as well as reconciling God and man. And finally, we see Paul focusing in the latter part of Ephesians chapter 3, middle to late, about the great gift that he personally had received, the revelation, the inspiration to be given the very mind of God that he might write it down for us, even beginning in the early part of chapter 3, that we might read and understand. And so, he begins with spiritual blessings, he ends with revelation in these first three chapters, and then turns in chapter 4, verse 1, to rubber meeting the road. Our calling. The response that human beings now are expected to have with regard to the great blessings and gifts of God in the first three chapters. What should we do about this? When a great gift comes your way, when someone gives you a thing that you know they spent a lot of time contemplating or creating, or perhaps a good amount of money has been spent, when you open up a gift that is truly impressive, gratitude is born in your heart. Gratitude is a powerful force. If you appreciate what someone has done for you, you want immediately to thank them, to show them, to respond in kind, to manifest somehow as best you can a like precious appreciation and gift for those individuals. And so with chapter 4 in verse 1, as Paul says there, I therefore, the prisoner of the Lord, entreat you to walk in a manner worthy of the calling with which you have been called. With, and then begin, what is, for actually several chapters, a long list of virtues that are descriptive to the character that you and I are to have. Look what God did in these three chapters for us. He calls us now, the great and the high calling, to be worthy of these gifts. That is, to give ourselves in the service of the King, that we might be exactly what those gifts would create. That we would be as valuable, that we would be as important in God's work and service as He has been in bestowing these good things upon us. It all begins and really ends, I guess, beginning, middle, and end, with the kind of people that we are to become. So he speaks of the unity that there is in Christ. I made a big point about this 2 weeks ago, made reference to it last week, and do it again this morning in case you haven't been with us. Those verses in chapter 4, verses 4 through 6, speak of these seven things, of which there is but one. First and foremost are to be appreciated, defended, practiced by the members of an individual congregation. We often think of them as a global or universal declaration of what people should believe in, across the surface of the earth. And that's true. We're not denying that. But often, I know I have at least, I've missed how important each one of these things is to keeping a congregation harmonized, united, integrated, working together, truly appreciating that we are a special and different people, separated out from all the rest of the world, and we are one with the purpose of preserving that unity, which of course then we will likewise take out into the world. Verses 7 through 11, as we saw last week, God offers, or 2 weeks ago I guess it was, more of these gifts to us that come with, if you will, strings attached in verses 12 through 16. Expectations that God has for us. Now, brethren, if any of you should be so lucky as to have parents who, for instance, would give you a brand new car, exactly what you wanted, the ideal dream machine, as a high school graduation present. Imagine. Would you then begrudge your parents saying, I would like for you to buy the insurance? I want you to put the air in the tires and pay for the gasoline? I expect that you'll wash this once in a while? Would you feel somehow that the care of this great gift is a burden too great to be borne? Who are you to tell me that I should have to take care of this great gift that you've given me? Well, any child that behaved like that, brother, we recognize would just be so horribly spoiled and selfish and ungrateful. You know how awful that would be. But God has given us something, these gifts, 29 of them as you read the rest of the book, brother, that so far surpass anything that we can imagine in the physical realm. It's like as if he gave us the car and a house and a lifetime income and vacation property in the Bahamas and on and on. But these things that he gave us were not physical. They're spiritual blessings. They are blessings of an internal and eternal nature. They are blessings of value that is incomprehensible. You can't compare it, with physical things. So when God has expectations, these expectations are so reasonable. They're so fair. They're so just. They're so right. But what we're about to discover, brethren, is that they are also so many. There's a lot of them. A lot of individual things that God would have us inculcate into our own spirit, into our own character and personality. And so we're coming to a section now, we've got 8 verses today, that speak of these things as being so comprehensive that they are entirely new self. Son, daughter, you're 18 years old. I'm going to give you the world.
okay? But I want you to clean your bedroom, you know, once a week. I want you to work in the garden. I want you, you know, to live up to this great gift.
I have an expectation then that you, son or daughter, will change your behavior, that you'll be different, that you will rise, you know, to this great calling. As most of you know, if you've been here any length of time at all, you know, I taught driver's ed for three and a half years. I taught driver's ed up in Washington State. I am never going to forget one family. They had a young son, 15 and a half, that's how old they all were, you know, when they came to me, who was just not ready. People grow and mature at different rates, and there's no shame in it. In the United States, in my humble opinion, we are much too eager to get kids out there driving, and a lot of them are not ready for it. And we have the fatality statistics to prove it. In Europe, you got to be 18. In Europe, driver's ed costs $5,000. Things are different in some other countries. I think we should learn something from that. But in America, it's a right, and it's a right of passage. You know, if a kid doesn't get his license at 16, why, his parents, they're just mean as mean co-seen. But you may know it is the email address for Dean Anderson. Okay? They're just mean, right? Well, he had to tell some parents one time, your son is just not ready. He needs at least another year or two. He can't concentrate. He's silly when he's behind the wheel. He's just young still. And that's okay, I try to tell him. You should be happy for that. Let him be a kid another couple of years. You know, I've grown kids of my own by that time. I said, you know, it's okay. He's not going to like it. But I was pleading with them for the sake of the child's life, for other people's life. He was not ready for a new self. He was not prepared to get behind the wheel. He was not mature. He was not complete. He had not perfected himself in the understanding of the forces that are at play and the necessity then of being able to reshape his mind to deal with a large number of circumstances that had ultimate consequences attached to them.
God comes to us and he says, if you come to Christ, you are ready to be made over altogether new. You are ready to shed your carnal self, your infantile self, your selfishness, yourself, to become what I, God, would have you be.
From this point on, especially in these verses, let's open now to chapter 4 and verse 17. We're going to see how he goes about that. But I threw this picture up for you to realize, brethren, the material we're about to look at, it's kind of like, you know, math exercise, English, you know, homework or something like that. It's not like I can go into the verses we're about to read and say, oh, see, you know, that's obscure and difficult. You need to understand all these passages over here. Now you put it together and see how beautiful, you know, that is. It's not like you get this great revelation. What you get is a laundry list of things that you need to go do. So it's not the kind of material, you know, that the child would say, oh, Mom, please, you know, another chapter before I have to go to bed. Read to me. You know, it's more like, all right, time to do your homework. Time to put on a new self. I'm going to tell you what this new self looks like. It isn't anything, you know, that's difficult to comprehend, save for the challenge. Do this. Do this consistently, do this constantly, do this without exception. Be this always, every day, no matter what your natural inclination might be. There is an old self, which we'll talk about first. There is a new self, which we will also talk about. In verse 17, he says this in the fourth chapter. This I say therefore, and affirm together with the Lord. That's about as much authority as anyone could ever, you know, cite. I affirm with the Lord that you walk no longer just as the Gentiles also walk in the futility of their minds, being darkened in their understanding, excluded from the life of God, because of the ignorance that is in them, because of the hardness of their heart. And they, having become callous, have given themselves over to sensuality for the practice of every kind of impurity with greediness.
Now, we'll come back to this in a second. We'll stop right here. Just look at this much. Brethren, the Jews and the Gentiles who have now been reconciled in Christ, according to a lengthy section in chapter 2, have received a very great spiritual blessing. There is now no distinction between them whatsoever. God will treat them exactly the same. But the fact of the matter is that the Gentiles, without the law of God in its clarity, written and delivered by Moses and preserved and practiced by means of an entire priesthood, you know, and teachers that God set up and operated for hundreds and hundreds of years, they, the Gentiles, did not have the oracles of God. And they were well known to this day and were at that time for the enormity of their sins, for how horrible they were, the murderous tendencies, the adulterous tendencies, and just every kind of sin that you can imagine. So the Jews, who had been spared a lot of that, because they had been cultivated by God for His own purposes, had that law, had those instructors, knew that they had been kept back from a lot of filth. And they appreciated that. So when He says to them, to these people, you know, don't be like Gentiles, it's powerful. Now, of course, Ephesus is a Gentile city. And He's writing to a lot of Gentiles at the same time. And they too had heard the gospel and come to appreciate the immorality that we had accepted, that we used to practice. It is vile. It is disgusting. It is filthy. It ought not to be attractive to us. It ought to be repulsive and disgusting. And they've come to appreciate that. So it's very powerful whether you're Jew or Gentile. In chapter 4, and in verse 17, when He affirms together with the Lord that you don't do that anymore. Do not behave as the Gentiles do, in the futility of their minds. Futility, a futile thing.
Resistance is futile.
Brought you Star Trek fans on the board. Okay. It is futile, then it accomplishes nothing. It's hopeless. There's no point in it. Now, brethren, you know, if you're in this room this morning, that to live a life of sin is futile. It does not bring anything like a permanent or satisfying happiness. The flesh, when you serve it and you gratify it, before very long at all, will pay you back, reaping what you sow. You will find yourself weakened and unhappy, your life devastated. You will find that there is no lasting confidence or enjoyment in it, you know, at all. The futility of their minds, they chased after the world. We are Christians. We belong to Jesus Christ. We are owned by Him. Those things we understand will not avail in the end. Ultimately, when the judgment comes, will surely be as futile as anything can be. I bring, dear God, at the judgment my money, my property, my strength, my skill in basketball, whatever it is that you gave your life to, and it's all futile. God cares for none of these things. They were darkened in their understanding. They had this futility in their mind because of a major problem that Paul is going to spend quite some time with. They do not understand. They are ignorant. They are without knowledge. And they are outside, therefore,
the life of God. The emphasis is right there. What he's trying to say is the life that God describes. They're outside the life that God would have us live. They're outside the life that God expects into man. They're outside a life that God is delivering to mankind and describing, so you know, we'll live that life and not so some other. The life of God is also the life that God himself lives. He does not lie. He does not cheat. He does not steal. He does not commit any of these crimes himself. If we would live the life of God, we are in the flesh living as God describes, as God would have us do, as God himself did when Emmanuel came, Jesus the Christ, God with us. But you want to highlight these two words right here. Because of the ignorance in the hard heart. So the problem with all the sinfulness and the futility and the darkened understanding and being outside the light of God, he used the phrase, is because of this. Because they didn't know anything. It's because they hadn't been properly taught. It's because they were ignorant. They didn't have the facts. And then also because of a hard heart then. They are turning away from God. They're not receptive. Now, this ignorance, brethren, can either because you never heard, you know, or because your heart is hardened, it just bounces off. You know, it's like being made like Iron Man and somebody is attacking you, you know, with Cocoa Crispy. And so your heart is hard, it's just bouncing off. This is what you get because of this. And then he says, and this is what you become. Callous, sensual, impure. You render yourself just filthy in the sight of God because you give yourself to live like these Gentiles in the futility of their minds, darkening the understanding outside the light of Christ. Because of this ignorance, they become, you know, these awful things. But what's the key for everything about this old self? It's all here because of what? Because of ignorance, because of a hard heart. So say to yourself, whoa. Look what happens if I just don't know the Word of God. Look what happens if I know it and I turn away from it. Those two things. I either don't know it or I won't do it. What you become is just a living cesspool of filth. Now then, he turns a corner in verse 20 to talk about the new self. So in verse 20, you did not learn Christ in this way. If indeed you have heard him and have been taught in him, just as truth is in Jesus, that in reference to your former manner of life, you lay aside the old self, which is being corrupted in accordance with the lust of deceit, and that you be renewed in the spirit of your mind and put on the new self, which in the likeness of God has been created in righteousness and holiness of truth. Go back over this for a minute. Look at the screen here at this point. Brethren, Christ is not just poof put upon you. You have to learn. Like that poor little girl, you know, doing her homework exercise. Christ must be learned. He is not bestowed. Christ is not himself just a gift of revelation as if you were an apostle suddenly imbued with all of the knowledge of God himself and all of the purity to live that life. It doesn't work like that. The problem over here was this. The solution over here is that. You need to hear it. You need to be taught. There's truth in Jesus. These things will give you the power, will give you the means, will give you the strength to lay aside all of that. Brethren, this is a trap. It's just like steel jaws. Once you get into that thing, it's very difficult to get out. And lacking the knowledge of Jesus the Christ, lacking the information, if you're in ignorance, you can't escape it. You're trapped. You're going to stay there. You're in a deep hole. And all you've got is your bare hands on muddy dirt walls. You are not getting out of there. what you need is this: to learn, to hear, to be taught, to acquire this truth. Then you can lay aside that old self.
At this point, I'm going to put another one over here,
because it is part of that old self there, verse 22. In reference to your former manner of life, you lay aside the old self, which is being corrupted in accordance with the lusts of deceit. Do you hear how present and ongoing that Greek tense is right there? Which is being corrupted. This is an ongoing process. This is a slide. This is a downhill run. It is always getting worse if you do not have this to pull you back up out of there. You are not going to get this done on your own. You are helpless and hopeless. But you learn Christ. You hear Christ. You're taught of Christ. And then this truth that you are learning enables you to lay aside a self that is continually getting worse. It reverses that process. And then coming back to verse 23 now, and that you be renewed in the spirit of your mind, put on a new self, which in the likeness of God has been created in righteousness and holiness of the truth. Okay, I want you to go home and do your exercises. You got your homework? Go home and work. See? So, you know, I wish, like so many times, you know, I think, in the preceding three chapters, you just kind of have these aha moments. Whoa, that is so majestic. That is so beautiful. That is so wise. That is so elegant. That is so complex. That has been worked out over so many centuries. There's just revelation, you know, this information in chapter 3. And then he says, go home now, and I want you to play the piano for an hour every day. You know, I want you to do those scales, up and down, up and down, up and down, up and down. I want you to go home, and I want you to, you know, work in the garden. I want you to do this, that, or nothing. But, Dad, it's drudgery. I like it. I enjoy it. Yeah, I know. Wax on. Wax off. Wax off. Wax off. That's what he's telling us to do. Now, if you don't know the original and the better of the Karate Kid movies, you know what that's about. You know, Mr. Miyagi teaching karate, you know, to his young protege there. He doesn't like wiping the car. He thinks he's being abused. No. He is learning something that is wise, that is powerful, that is ultimately effective, that has usefulness in your life, that can protect and defend you and others. Great movie, my kids and I were watching that. It must be 30 years ago now. Brethren, here's what happens. You come out of a training renewed in the spirit of your mind with a righteousness that is born and created of truth, and a holiness that comes from the same place. You rise up out of that pit, cleansed of all that mud and filth, perfumed and coiffed, you know, and dressed because of the knowledge of Jesus the Christ. Here's the point of this sermon, and we're done. Brethren, that's the problem. And this is the problem. If I don't know it, or I won't do it, then I become this. But if I turn myself and I devote myself, I actually spend time with that book that we call the Bible. Lots of time. Regular time. The knowledge that I acquire renews the spirit of my mind to a righteousness and a holiness that is God's heavenly calling, which we are to walk worthy in this life. Can you do that? Yes, you can do that. Of course you can do that. If we can help you do that, then let's please stand and sing. And as we're singing, if you have a prayer request, a desire for Bible study, a question to ask, or some such, please step forward and let it be known.